Pool days call for cookouts and lots of laundry. This Memorial Day at Lowe's, save $80 on a Charbroil Performance Series 4-Burner Gas Grill. Now just $199. Plus, get up to 45% off select major appliances to keep dishes, clothes, and food fresh. Having fun in the sun is easy with us in your corner. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 5/27. While supplies last, selection varies by location. See associate or Lowe's.com for details.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino, the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. In this season, season 18 of Truth and Justice, we are highlighting justice warriors in the true crime space. And today's episode is this beginning. I don't know. It may be a little clunky when it's done because we're doing an interesting crossover thing. But I am lucky enough for the first time ever to have my very good friend and mentor, who I've been working with now for over 10 years, sitting in the studio across from me at the table, not on Zoom, but sitting right here in the room with me, former FBI profiler, writer of Criminal Minds, former New York City prosecutor. He's done it all amongst all the Audible originals, all these things. My good friend Jim Clemente is sitting right here. Say hello, Jim.
How you doing, Bob? It's great to be here. And of course, you called me a mentor. We've been mentoring each other because you were in the podcast space before I was. In fact, I think what it was you told me, hey, Jim, every time you come on my podcast, the numbers go up.
Yeah.
You should have your own podcast. And I thought about it. And then Lisa Zambetti came up to me and said, I would love to do a podcast. And I said, you know what? I was talking to Bob about it. Let's do it. And then we brought Laura in to have another voice because our process, when you're a profiler, doing it alone is very limiting. And the more minds you have tearing a problem apart, I think the better product you get. And when Lisa came in, she could ask the questions, and she did a tremendous amount of research, but she could also ask the questions that our listeners were wondering. Because sometimes when you're a professional, You sort of get blinders on. You know exactly what's important, but there are a lot of questions out there that Lisa helped us really focus on what our listeners wanted to hear. And so as time went on, Lisa went on to another career. She's still casting, but she went on to another career in counseling, and Laura went on to her podcast. So I was fortunate enough to bring on my former colleague at the FBI in the behavioral analysis unit, and that is
Kathy Canning Mello.
Yeah, Kathy and I worked together for more than a decade in the BAU, and we chased a lot of child abductors and sex offenders and serial killers and all sorts of bad people. And so I was really happy that Kathy was able to join me on Real Crime Profile, and we have been really doing some pretty serious analysis on all the cases that come up, sometimes in the media, sometimes not in the media. And of course, we also talk about cases that we investigated ourselves over the course of our careers.
Yeah. So Kathy, this is the first time I've got to meet Kathy, and I was so glad when you joined the show. You know, when Laura and Lisa left, it was that Real Crime Profile couldn't die, right? Mm-hmm. The, you know, is not just as, you know, a podcast that people like listening to, with the education that you guys do for people and all the good work you do. And you've been an amazing, amazing fit, Kathy. So I want to know, tell me, how did Jim talk you into podcasting?
First of all, thank you very much for that compliment. I really appreciate it. It wasn't difficult. You know, Jim and I have been friends now for decades, and we worked so well together when we were in the BAU. So it seemed like it was a natural fit. The timing worked with what was happening in my life at the time. I had, my husband and I had just renovated this mother of a fixture-upper.
Yeah.
And I just happened to have this empty closet that we, you know, fitted out for this podcast. So it all just kind of worked out great. And I really enjoy delving into these crimes, you know, and specifically, I like to talk about crimes that don't see a lot of headlines, right? It's always mm-hmm. interesting to me to pick the ones that, you know, are falling through the cracks, or just, you know, it's that they're just not making the news for whatever reason, but we find them interesting. We find them important. And those are the cases that we really need to amplify to have the audience out there, an audience of listeners to help to try to solve those crimes.
You know, so what I'd like to do in that regard, and this is all, by the way, for you guys to listen to this, not only is it a little complicated, we're crossing it over, but also this all came together about an hour ago and we're like, hey, let's have Kathy, you're here, let's get in the studio and do this. So I'm putting you on the spot, kind of. But I would like to, usually we like to talk about a case or something you guys are covering. One thing I do want to kind of circle back to it. So Jim is on the advisory committee for my broadcast journalism program that I teach in high school. And he, twice a year, he zooms in and participates in the committee where he kind of advises us on what we should be doing, you know, moving forward in the class. On today, because he's here, he just, we should point that out too. Jim was, you know, doing a road trip and just reached out to me a couple of days ago and was like, hey, I'm passing through your area. You know, should I stop by? So Jim stopped by last night. We had a barbecue and hung out.
Yeah, it's great.
Yep. Then I drug him to the school today. The kids were enthralled. I've never had them pay attention to me as much as they did. I stepped out of the room for 5 freaking minutes and I come back in and there's a semi, half of whom aren't even in my class. I don't know where they came from. There's a semicircle of kids just, Jim's holding court just in a circle, just hanging on every word that he said. And you were talking about the Nancy Guthrie case, one of them had asked you about.
Yeah, well, Kathy and I have talked about it. And the fact is that that case, there's a lot of anomalies in that case, right, Kathy?
Yeah,
it is not what we would normally see in a kidnapping case. And kidnapping, by the way, just so you know, is a federal crime. But it's when you abduct somebody and demand a ransom. That makes it a kidnapping. Other than that, it's an abduction, and there can be multiple motives for that. But the fact that this was a kidnapping, yet the ransom notes, which at least Savannah Guthrie has said two of them were legitimate, they didn't come till days later.
Right.
And they didn't go to the family. They went to the media.
Yeah, right.
And what does that tell us? Yeah. This is totally an anomaly in all the abduction cases, child abduction, kidnapping cases that we've seen where there was a demand for ransom. Those messages were left at the scene or delivered to the family members. And they usually have a demand. No police. And no media.
Mm-hmm.
Yet these were sent to the media. So that tells us that this is an important motive. This leaks out information about the offender. The offender wanted the attention, wanted the media involved, and didn't care that that meant that the police would be involved immediately. So they may never have even intended to get money, but they wanted the attention that it brought. And what attention did they get? Savannah Guthrie came on TV, talked directly to the offender, and then went on social media again. Pleas were made to the offender. And this may be exactly what the offender wanted. In other words, he didn't want the money. He didn't want the mother. He wanted Savannah. Maybe he wanted her attention. Maybe he wanted to punish her. But that's That's really what I see in this crime. And I don't know. A lot of people are talking about a whole bunch of other speculations. But what do you think, Kathy?
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. In fact, I just read today that the police are saying publicly that they're getting closer to solving this crime. So that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. It's always kind of difficult for us after we leave the Bureau and we have to rely on the media's information, right?
Right.
We're told since going back to when we were agents, you never can really rely 100% on what the media is saying. So we are drawing conclusions on information that may not be accurate, but do the best we can given our experience and our training in these types of crimes.
Right. And what we saw, I mean, the most telling piece of evidence that we saw, and it was delivered by media. In other words, they went and took videos and stills of the blood spatter patterns on the outside of the house. Now, that means that the crime scene was not protected. That's the first big error, I believe. But looking at that blood spatter evidence, it told an incredible story. Nancy Guthrie was absolutely 100% alive when she left that house. She was not being carried out of that house because she was on the ground, dripping blood and coughing up blood. Now, if two people had control of her, I don't think she ever would have gone to the ground.
Right.
If one person was there and she decided to not cooperate at that moment when she got outside, because remember, she probably was stunned. She was probably in shock being awoken by a masked man in the middle of the night. Taken down to the front door and then led outside of the house. This is probably where she put up her last stand, and she was punished for. She was punched or somehow hit in the face, and she bled. She was probably hit in her nose and mouth, and she aspirated some of that blood. She breathed it in and then coughed it up. But she was very close to the ground. Her face was right above the ground, just inches above the ground. And that's based on the spatter pattern. There's low velocity blood droplets that are very obvious there. And there's also medium velocity droplets. Now, that's because of the viscosity of blood. In order to get smaller droplets, it has to be moving faster. And to get like, for example, the results of a gunshot wound, you'll see almost a misting of blood, very tiny droplets, and that's high velocity blood. So we know that there's low velocity and medium velocity, and there looks like there's evidence of blood bubbles, which again, that would mean there would be air in that blood droplet as it came out and impacted with the ground. So that also reinforces that it was aspirated and coughed up. But after that, there's very few and far between blood droplets that are still look like they're straight up and down. So she's not moving fast, but I believe at that point she was probably picked up and carried with her mouth up so that the blood wasn't dripping as much and then put into a vehicle and taken away. The good thing about that is she was alive. And the other good thing is she most likely deposited more blood and other evidence inside that vehicle.
Sure.
And hopefully when that vehicle is recovered, they'll be able to get some of that evidence and prove the connection to the crime.
And the terrific thing is we have photos of the offender.
Mm-hmm.
He's disguised, but I still think that if they find the person, they'll be able to
identify. First year in the FBI, I was on the bank robbery squad, and every single bank robber, we put a height scale into the image and knew exactly how tall the person was. We can make really precise determinations as to their weight. And we saw how he walked around. We saw how he moved. We also saw his eyes. We also saw what looked like a tattoo on the other underside of his wrist. There are a lot of things that are going to identify him. I've said a number of times, and I know you've agreed, that there is a high probability that this person will be identified because of that. Also, I understand the FBI is working on hair evidence. I don't know where they recovered that. I'm not certain that it's related to the crime, but if it is, they will get use forensic genetic genealogy, and they will determine who this person is mm-hmm. to the person. It will be absolute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this case, and actually, so just what I was going to say a few minutes ago was, we'll come back to Nancy Guthrie, but let's pick a case that isn't in the headline. But now you got me. Same as you did my kids. I'm in. Sorry. Now I need to know more about this.
ask questions. Sorry.
Because the case feels very much, I didn't follow, I saw in the news, I saw little bits of it in the news, and it was one of those things, thought, well, this is going to resolve itself pretty quickly, and now it's 90 days later. But the video that we have, it has all these, like, reminiscent for me of like the Delphi case. I remember when in 2017, when Abby and Libby were murdered, you know, we had a picture, we had a still, it wasn't great, but we have an image of this guy walking. We're like, oh, they're going to find him immediately. In this day and age of social media and everything. And then, you know, it was years later, and then they who knows if they got the right guy even at this point, but
I'm pretty confident. How about you, Kathy?
Yeah.
We might circle back around to that too. But this one, it's like, yeah, he's wearing a mask, but it's 2026. You can see a tattoo. You can see his eyes. You can see his build. Like, how has in 3 months, nobody's been like, yep, that's him.
Well, yeah. We don't know that nobody's been like that. Yep. There's developing suspects. Yep. There's also proving that the crime. And so, I think, and it's good that they're doing it, that the police are holding back serious information about the leads they're following and so forth. Every time I've gone on the news to discuss this case, I've always made a plea to people. Somebody out there knows him. Somebody out there works with him. Somebody might even live with him.
Yeah.
And we said from the beginning that knew her and was familiar with her home and...
Yeah, it could be a passing familiarity, but it's somebody that most likely had some connection to her, whether it's through Ubering or lifting or delivering or repairing or, a pool boy, whatever. Somebody who she probably very innocently talked about her daughter to, and unfortunately put the plant in their mind that well, maybe she's got money or she's worth money or maybe she can get me access to this to this star, this Savannah Guthrie. So, there's not a lot of indicators that this was for money. It wasn't a burglary to get items out of the house. And there's no indication that there was a sexual motive. And the evidence that it is a monetary motive through kidnapping is very weak and very inconsistent with the cases that we have seen in our careers. So that's why I kind of gravitate towards some kind of fixation. And that could be a positive or negative fixation. In other words,
on Savannah
yeah. or the mother, but most likely on Savannah, because the result of what this person did was he actually did garner the attention of Savannah and direct communication from Savannah, and he didn't get any money and he didn't get anything else of value. So that's why I think that's probably what happened. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, he went in there for one thing and then things went terribly wrong. We know of no evidence that anything went terribly wrong in that house. Not a single thing. Mm-hmm. This is a man who went in there with a gun, very visible, clearly easy to control, an 84-year-old woman with a gun. And then we know of evidence of an assault outside. Mm-hmm. And we know of no evidence inside of an assault. So now the police may have information, but what's public doesn't tell me that anything went horribly wrong in that house. I think everything went exactly as planned in that house. It was when they got outside that things went awry for the offender, because I believe Nancy stood up for herself and refused to go any further.
It's It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day Sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now, we went into this without a plan at all. I have a plan now, guys.
Okay.
Yeah. You want a plan? I don't know if I do well with plans.
I have a plan. Well, I actually forgot that, you know, when Richard Allen's trial was going on, that you guys had talked about it and that you had made some posts about them or on your podcast that you're certain he was guilty. I had, there's people on the other side where I am at, to be clear. After studying everything that we now know that happened at the trial, which is, you know, because the biggest thing is everybody was making their opinions without having any information, mm-hmm. right? I'm not in the camp of Richard Allen's innocent. I am in the camp, and I want to see if you can convince me otherwise, or maybe for the first time ever we get to disagree on something. But I am in the camp of I am exceptionally uncomfortable with the trial and the case against him.
Really?
Yeah. Big. I mean, in my opinion, when I've gone through everything that's been released from the transcripts from the trial and everything that came out, the evidence that they have against him is extremely, extremely weak, in my opinion. So I'm curious, you guys are both like,
What is it that's weak? Well, tell me.
You tell me.
No, it's not.
You're the prosecution.
I am not the prosecution in this case. Had I been the prosecution, I would have a better grasp of that evidence. But what I'm asking you, I didn't get a chance to go through all the transcripts. I've been working on other cases.
Right.
But if you, what is it about the evidence that you feel is weak?
Well, I'll do it this way, but you're asking me to prove a negative when you made the statement that he's guilty. So what I would ask is, why do you think he's guilty? Because I'm still very unsure. You seem more sure than me. What is it about the case, and this is for both of you guys, what is it about the case that leads you to believe so strongly that they got the right guy?
The three things that I could say is the fact that he was there, the fact that a bullet from his gun was found in between the two bodies or near the two bodies.
Okay.
And the statements that he made that were proven to be false. Those are the three things that I know about.
Okay. We'll start by the easy one, the bullet.
Okay.
This is one of the things I'm very uncomfortable with. You just said a bullet from his gun was found between the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys have looked into this, but when that actually came out in trial, when the expert testified,
mm-hmm.
what actually happened was it was a spent shell casing
mm-hmm.
was found near the body. They confiscated and warrant his 40 cal, or he gave them his 40 caliber gun. The firearms examiner test fired 6 rounds through his gun, and none of them matched the bullet. They were not similar to there were no similarities.
Wait, why do you have to test fire anything? It's the ejection that would be on the
Well, right. That's why they had to fire the bullet, because it was a spent casing. So they fired it, so they had spent casings from his gun to compare.
So you're saying that that never matched his gun?
Did not. Did not. But this is how they got there. So I think there was 10. My numbers may be wrong, but conceptually, this is what happened.
Okay.
So they fired, I believe, 6 different times through his gun so they could get an actual spent casing from his gun, mm-hmm. compared them, no match. So then they started testing unspent rounds, just ejecting them from the gun.
Right.
Which to me is already a problem, because you're trying to compare a shot that was actually fired through the gun to a shot that was not fired through the gun.
Okay.
Of those, I think there was 4. They were able with one of them to say there was enough similarities that they couldn't rule out it was his. So to me, it's first of all, it was a huge stretch for the prosecution from the PR side when they're like, a bullet from his gun was there. Like, mm-hmm. at best, there's a bullet that could have maybe come from his gun was there.
Okay.
It's also important context. They tested other guns, another guy that lived right there. A bullet from his gun also couldn't be
ruled out. Okay.
So it's not like there was like this unique thing where it was like it came from his. And so this is what I mean when I'm saying I'm uncomfortable with it. I totally get it.
Yeah. But he was there, right? His car was parked across the street.
He was there.
Right.
Yeah, that he was there earlier in the day.
Right.
That he's seen him. Now, as far as the, you know, there was lots of people there.
Right. Well, not lots, but, you know.
I mean, there was a pretty good number of folks that testified that they were in and out of there that day.
But not a whole lot of lone men that had that kind of gun. And that made inconsistent statements that were proven false. That's what I'm saying. It's the 3 things together. Now, look, I didn't know. I mean, because the prosecution had stated that it was a bullet from
the
gun.
Right, when you're getting from what the media, and the media all reported it that way, right? Mm-hmm. So I was very uncomfortable. You know, at first, when I heard it, I was like, because like, I have no dog in this fight, right? So, you know, I was like, they got him. Thank God, finally they got him. And I know Kelsey. I know, you know, I want this to be the guy. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, that's what you have? And then there was he's there. The prosecution was able to put up a few witnesses that saw Britt, like literally in the timing worked out where they were passing by, past a guy that was walking to the bridge. Not a single one of them was able to identify Richard Allen as that person. None of them were able to.
Okay.
I also have an issue with the fact when the FBI, this came out, I think after trial, we didn't know this until this. The FBI was originally part of the case, or at some point was part of the case, was in helping investigate. They were looking at a guy named Ron Logan, who they filed a search warrant for his house, did a probable cause affidavit. In the probable cause affidavit for the guy that lives right there, for Ron Logan, they noted in there that they had done photogrammetry on the picture. Well, they didn't say we did photogrammetry, but they said, you know, they analyzed and investigated the bridge guy photo and video, and part of the probable cause in the probable cause affidavit was that Ron Logan's build was similar to
the guy in the photo.
Ron Logan is 6'3". Richard Allen is 5',
wow,
6, something like that. So, you know, part of that for me was like, well, if the FBI analyzed it and said this guy's about or close to 6'3", then how are we now saying it's 5'6"?
When you say build, though, did they specifically said that he's the same height, or
said
did
build.
They
so,
say
they
but
said?
Yeah, but build is different. Build is, you know, it's got scale to it. It could be somebody tall, somebody small, but the proportions is build. Like the legs length and the arm length and the upper body length are all proportionate. But did they actually say that the guy on the bridge was 6'4"?
No. So this was another one of the things when I'm reading it, mm-hmm. and I'm looking at what indications do, because everybody, right? So everybody is like, I looked at it, that guy's clearly 5'6". I looked at this guy's clearly that. Nobody fucking knows, right? Mm-hmm. Unless they're.
Well, what we did it in bank robberies, right? So
yeah.
I was just talking about it.
That's what made me think of it. Yeah.
So. You can insert a scale as long as he's walking by, objects, trees, whatever.
Yeah.
That they can, you know, judge based on how high he went by there and so forth.
Right.
It's why, you know, every 7-Eleven has a height chart, right? As you go in. But, you know, I don't know exactly what they did. Again, I didn't.
Well, it wasn't clear either. So, like, mm-hmm. to me, it was just me looking at, okay, what? Because really, when I saw what the evidence they convicted him on, I'm like, ah.
Yeah, well, like, Kathy, what do you think? I mean, this is raising issues.
I don't have enough information. I would have studied up on this case.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, that does, what you're saying does actually raise issues, you know, and obviously that's not what you want in a case. You want beyond a reasonable doubt to be beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I wish we, you know, I wish I actually had, you know, reviewed all the transcripts and so forth. But again,
more so than anything, it'd be interesting for me as you guys, as profilers, as I give you some of the information, which obviously this is just me. So obviously anybody should fact check and do their own research. But I'm curious your thoughts on, because it's one of those things, because I learned the way I think about investigations primarily from you. That, you know, over the years, right? And so that's, you know,
come on, you were a fire investigator, right?
Yeah, but you know what I mean? As far as that, you know, I've taken that and I've learned a lot from you. And so I'm always looking at everything with skepticism, always. Mm-hmm. And
smart.
And when I was looking at this case, so the bullet thing, I was like, oh, well, that's weak. And then I did notice you didn't put in your list the confessions, which I don't know if that was intentional or not,
yeah,
but
it was,
agree
because,
with that.
Because I think, you know, there were issues raised with the confessions, right? And wasn't he talking to his wife on the phone?
There's a whole slew of things you can go on forever, but they, you know, they locked him into solitary forever. They took away his iPad so he couldn't communicate with anybody. He was in a full cycle. I mean, he was eating feces and spray. I mean, he was out of his mind.
Well, isn't that normal though?
No. Yeah, right. You know, he had got, and once he
was
in
joking,
that point,
by the way,
and his psychologist actually noted, the prison psychologist actually noted in a report that he was in a full state of psychosis when all of a sudden he starts confessing to his wife. But when you hear, because they're available now, you hear the confessions, his confessions are, well, what if I did it? I think I did it. What if I did do it? Would you still love, and it was all, would you still love me if I did do it? What if I, and that's what they call confession. Then finally, eventually she, with this, and then there's all these issues. The psychologist was like in all these like Facebook groups about the case, and she was obsessed. She lied to stay there about something with her background so she could, because she wanted to be involved in the case. She is sitting there with him when he calls his wife and gives the confession, right? Where he says, yeah, I did it. And he starts to give, because when I was listening through them, I'm like, that's not a confession, is a story. If a confession has a beginning, middle, and end, him saying, I think maybe I did it, is not a confession. He finally gives a story, right? And now at this point, we know the psychologist has details of the case through these Facebook groups and stuff she's on. One of them being, they found a bullet. They knew there was a shell casing. In his case, and one of the things that triggered me was he's telling her this story. He's like almost like going through point by point, trying to hit these points of, you know, they knew there was a van drive by, then a van drove by and scared me, which was later proven the timing doesn't work out for that because of the security family, but that's what they thought, and that's what comes in his confession. And he says, as we're going down the hill, he says, oh, and I did something with my gun and the bullet came out. So he explains the bullet, except for in the story.
Are you saying they fed him that information?
I think the psychologist fed him that information. But also, because she didn't know the details, right? So he says, yeah. So now the bullet's explained. The problem is, in the story, when he says, I did something with the gun, he doesn't say I racked or whatever. He says, I did something with the gun, the bullet came out. It was, by the way, I said something wrong earlier. I'll circle back to. Where he says he did it was up on the hill before they went down the hill. But where the bullet was actually found, the casing was found, was down the hill across the creek over by the bodies. So the place in his story where he says it happened.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good. But it reminds me, remember Kathy, it was like a 2-year-old girl. The father calls, not 911, the non-emergency number, and says, my daughter's missing. She wasn't even 2. I think she was less than 2. And it was in this area. Like it was Detroit or something in Michigan. I can't remember the name of the victim, but the father calls. He's like, yeah, you know, my daughter's missing. And they start taking the information, and he said, what's her date of birth? And He says, you know, whatever. And I don't know, the daughter's like 6 months old. And he's like, she's 6 months old? Why did you tell me? Oh my God. You know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, eventually, you know, the cops came to us, they had a confession, they did all this stuff, right? And, you know, it seemed like it fit. Like he did that. The wife was away running a track meet. He's trying to pick up some other woman and, you know, yada, yada, yada. He was obviously doing drugs and things like that. Anyway, in the end, it turns out his confession was fed to him by the police. Wow. They didn't record the first 4 hours of the interrogation. Mm. And so as he's feeding the details that to us look like, wow, well, he has this detail, this detail, this, oh, this is all, he got the duct tape here, he did this, he got, well, it turns out that he was railroaded.
Yeah.
But we were only presented what the detectives told us.
Right.
They actually railroaded him.
Yeah.
It could happen in this case. I don't know. But you know, if you're not in the investigation, if you don't have every detail, it's very difficult to be certain one way or the other.
And that's why my position on it comes in. I'm just very uncomfortable because I there's no piece of evidence in his case where it's like I can hang my hat on it and say, so like you mentioned, he gave provably false statements. To my knowledge, the thing I need to correct real quick, I said it was a spent shell casing. It's the other way around. It was an unspent shell casing.
Right.
So they tried 6 times
to eject it.
And those wouldn't match. They had to fire one. They had fire 4, and one of the 4 they fired matched. So anyway, I just was bass backwards. I want to make sure.
Yeah, okay. So that makes a lot more sense in terms of what happened at the scene. In other words, he used the gun to control them.
Scare them, yeah.
Well, he used the gun to control them and then to ratchet it up. He didn't know if there was a round in the chamber.
Right.
So he racked it. Now he knows there's a round in the chamber, but one of them went flying because there was already a round in the chamber.
Yeah.
Right? That's what happened.
What I imagine, you tell me if this makes it, because of where it's at, right? He's controlling 2 girls, whoever it is, right? And with a gun, and then they're where they end up being murdered. Obviously, there's 2 of them, and he didn't kill them with a gun, so he had to kill one, then the other.
Right.
I picture do this in, you know, like you, like, doing what he sees people do on TV to scare him, whether there was a chamber round in there or not, like, I'll shoot you, you know, like, you know,
yeah,
that's right, what I kind of picture.
That's very possible. But certainly you can control 2 people with 1 gun by putting it to one of their heads and saying, I'll kill her if you don't do this.
Right.
And then you get that person out of commission and then you have 1 more.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
But anyway, as far as the false statement, it was another, not quite this, but so we have two recorded interviews with him, video, everything. You can watch the whole thing. I would love for you guys for this to be a case that you actually do a deep dive on the show, because I'd be super interested, because you have statement analysis.
Yeah, now you can that do. We have all that. Yeah.
Because so the false statements they put out. So the day they asked anybody that was at the park that day or at the trails that day to come forward. He goes in voluntarily, says, "Hey, I was there," gives a statement. He gives a statement to, I believe it was like a DNR officer who writes down what he says.
DNR?
Like Department of Natural Resources, like game warden type guy.
Okay.
And that's who originally takes the statement. Well, then years later, when they bring him in to interview him at the police station, they confront him with, you know, he's like, "Well, what time did you leave?" Now it's years later too. And he's like, "I left, it would have been around 1 o'clock or what, I don't remember the date," right? And they're like, "Well, you said you left it. You originally said you left at 12:30. Now, what he says in the interview, he's like, "That's not what I said."
Oh, really?
And they're like, "No, you said, you told him that you did this and you drove this route and you did da 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 da." And he was saying that's nice. So it got presented as, well, he changed the story and changed his time. And maybe he did. Maybe it's a memory thing. Maybe he changed it. But we don't have a recording of the original. Right. We just have like a secondhand
recollection. Yeah, right.
Not that they were like framing or anything back there, but there's certainly a potential for a margin of error in that. But it was, the more I investigated it, when I was really looking in the FBI's work, because, you know, they kicked the FBI off the case right before they arrested him.
Really? Because of the inconsistency.
My guess is because the FBI, from what I can see in the files, they were focused on this guy, Ron Logan, who died in 2020, who lived next door. But for me, as far as, and again, I'm not saying he's innocent, not saying this other guy, Ron Logan's guilty. But for me, if I'm looking for who's the best suspect here, Ron Logan, they interview him. The day while they're looking for them. No one knows the girls have been murdered yet.
Right.
He, according to the FBI's probable cause affidavit, tells them from this time to this time, which was the time the murder happened, which no one knew there was even a murder yet.
Right.
I went with my cousin and I was out of town. I was going to buy fish food or something somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
They checked the receipt. He did go there, but not till way later that night. Then they talked to his cousin, who tells them, "He called me and told me to say that he was
going fish food."
Right. We call that a clue in the FBI.
Right. So it was like, and it seemed like, and in my opinion, rightly so, that was the suspect that the FBI was more focused on.
And did the defense not bring in any of this in the trial?
They were handcuffed by most of this shit. They wouldn't allow any like third party suspects, any of that stuff. So they weren't allowed to
The defense wasn't.
Uh-uh.
And so, I mean, I imagine this is all going to come up in an appeal.
Well, that's the thing is there's a lot of people, both who think Richard Allen's either innocent or that think that it just, that, you know, have problems with the conviction like me, that Gall, the judge, was just a nightmare. I mean, we've had several attorneys on that are like, this thing is going to should get overturned because of all this shit that the judge did.
Right.
Completely handcuffing but it was just, it'd be a great one for you guys to look at, because you've got all the audio is available of the phone confessions. You got two video recorded interviews to do statement analysis on. Cause I kind of did my own version of that looking at him. And when I watched the police interviews, he did what you told me years and years ago. I remember you telling me when I would talk to somebody about a wrongful conviction, when I'm first interviewing people about it, you always told me you need to ask them straight up, did you do this? And you need to listen for their reaction.
Right.
And I remember you telling me that like an innocent person, a lot of times will get angry at that question.
Yeah. And they'll get angrier the more times you ask it.
Right.
As opposed to somebody who's guilty, who usually will back off and try to obfuscate and.
Right. And that's what, in the Richard Allen interview, they keep accusing him. He keeps getting pissed, and he's getting more pissed. And they're very like textbook read technique. They try to back him to a corner. They lie to him about how, you know, this evidence, so they present him with the bullet, right? "We know for a fact your bullet was here," read technique, right? "Now we've caught you. Now we've got the evidence." And he's like, "That's not true. That's impossible."
Did they tell him that the ballistics have come back and it matches your gun?
Yeah.
They told him that.
And he just continued to say,
"All right," but that in and of itself may get the case overturned.
Sure.
Because you're not allowed to make up that test results point to him. That is something the Supreme Court has said.
Really?
For decades.
That doesn't fall under, they can lie to him?
No, they can't lie about test results,
okay,
forensic test results that came back. They can say, what happens if this bullet comes back to your gun? How are you going to explain that? But they can never say, if it hasn't come back, they can never say, it has come back and it goes to your gun. Absolutely. Unless it does.
Well, they have their result. They did have the results that said, the ones I explained to you, that could be consistent. So
yeah, but if they said it could be consistent with your gun versus it says that it was your gun.
Oh, no. Yeah, they 100% put it on him that it was.
All right, well, to me.
So where does that fall in? I know we're getting off track, but does it? Because I've always, you know, the Supreme Court ruling says police officers are allowed to lie to suspects. But there's a line there.
The line is you cannot fake forensic test results.
Okay.
You can say, we're going to test this. If it comes back to you, how do you explain that? You can't say it came back to you if it hasn't. So you can't lie about the results of the test.
It was found at the scene, right?
They can say something like, well, why would your fingerprint be here?
Absolutely.
But they can't say your fingerprint is here.
Correct.
So they do that. They tell him it matches. And I'm watching to see, like, how, because, you know, in Reed technique, once you confront him with the evidence, right? Now, I mean, you guys both know this. But, yeah. Now you want him to start, then you back him into a corner, then you give him a way out, right? So they start doing that. They start trying to give him a way out. And he doesn't bite for a second. All he keeps doing is saying, that's not possible. Nope. No. Well, how do you explain this? He's like, I can't explain it. I don't know. It's impossible. It is impossible for my bullet to be there. So, you know, my take on it was either this guy is more incredible of a liar than anybody I've ever seen, or that's not his bullet.
Mm. Well, that's really, this is really distressing, you know, as I hear this, because I remember, Kathy, when they announced that the murders were solved, that they made the arrest and, you know, and they made the statement that this bullet was from his gun and that he had lied about things that were provably wrong and that he had admitted that he was in the area at the time.
Yeah.
Well, early, I think he said he was there earlier, but I think, you know, there's some kind of surveillance of his
car being at the parking lot.
Yeah. At the right
time. Or driving by the store there.
At the right time. So anyway, it sounded to me like they knew what they were doing. And, you know, I've met some of the investigators in that case. You know, and I would assume that they are legit and they wanted to get the right guy, but it sounds like this Logan guy may be a better bet. I don't know.
He could, you know, that guy could be, Ron Logan could be completely innocent, but if I was weighing who's a better suspect with actual evidence, to me, it's not even close.
Why? What's the evidence against him? Well, so the fact that he's right there.
He's right there. He lied about his alibi, asked somebody to lie about his alibi for him before they even knew the murders happened.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is an indicator that he's being deceptive. It's not an indicator that he committed the murders.
Right. Another reason.
He could be having an affair.
Right.
And that's why he was covering up. So you have to drill down and get much more information.
Yeah.
But that doesn't look great for him, but just it doesn't in and of itself mean he committed
right.
the murders. What is his... You know, does he have any sex offender history?
So he's got a history of violence against women. There is his ex, and I'm speaking from memory here, so just take this with a grain of salt. But from what I remember, his ex had like called the police when she heard that when they showed the video or when she heard the voice or whatever, actually called the police and said, that's him. Like the way he's walking, the way he sounded, I don't remember what it was, but then we find out later that he has a history of sexual violence with her. He ends up in prison. He died. I think he was in prison when he died. But then, I always take with a grain of salt, but there's some interesting things here. There's a guy from prison who writes a letter to the prosecutor that says this guy, Ron Logan, confessed to me that he committed these murders. And the guy, he's not asking for anything. He's not where he's like plea bargaining. The guy's just like, he writes this letter to the prosecutor. Prosecutor buried it, by the way.
Wow.
That came out later.
All right. That's the second overturn
right
in appeal event.
But in the confession, I'm always, you know, I deal with wrongful conviction. So I deal with jailhouse snitches all the time, right? So I, you know, usually there's some motive there. But what caught me as interesting is he talked about how he got them and where he took them and what he did with them, and that he slit their throat with a box cutter. Mm. What jumped out at me was he wrote that in 2017, 2018, I don't remember when it was. No one
had reported that.
No one knew the cause of death until the trial or shortly before the trial. Oh, and that was the biggest frustration with anybody that was like, you know, legitimate investigative reporters that were working, like they kept that so close to the vest. Mm-hmm. We didn't know, because that was one of my, is like, you know, if you're trying to engage the public, like nobody even knows, we don't know anything. They had some FBI, former FBI profilers that would talk about the case. I'm like, how can you profile a case? You don't even know how they were killed. You've never seen the crime scene. You've never seen the photos. Mm-hmm. So when he wrote in there that Ron Logan told him he slit their throat with a box cutter, which he did slit their throat, and the ME testified it very likely could have come from a box cutter, no one knew that.
Well, I mean, this is all new to me.
Yeah.
But this is all very, very, very distressing. I mean, we've seen this in other cases before, you know,
mm-hmm.
where somebody gets blinders on and they just, you know, they just force the case in a particular direction, and that's not good. But this guy, I mean, hopefully the FBI is waiting in the wings to go after the real killer if this guy gets off on appeal, because it sounds like at least there are two major errors, legal errors. I mean, hiding evidence of another suspect, the prosecution doing that. You're saying they absolutely buried that evidence?
I said that, and I should back up a little bit, because I'm speaking a little bit out of turn, because I don't remember exactly that. I don't recall that it was like this is a, because that would be a clear and obvious Brady violation. Mm-hmm. There was so. Perhaps they didn't. It might have been turned over to the. There was something wonky with it, okay. Is what I remember. I wasn't as clear, because everybody in every one of my audience knows that's a Brady violation, right? You know, you have to be a lawyer to know that. So it may have been something to do more with the judge and the thing she was, because she suppressed everything from the defense. She wouldn't let them have any kind of defense at all.
All right. Well, that just makes no sense to
throughout
me.
The entire thing.
Hopefully, I mean, you know, look. Good judges, when there's a strong case against the defendant, will bend over backwards to give the defense everything.
Because they don't want it overturned.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound like that's what happened here.
That's not what happened here. And somebody asked in here another good question. They said whether he's guilty or not. They want to know, for you guys, your thoughts on this type of crime and this type of violence. From a profiler's perspective, would you expect this to be committed by someone with zero history of any violence, sexual violence, criminal record, nothing? That this is at least what they've been caught, and they were not able to produce any evidence from anybody, even anecdotally, I can say that word, I think, that he's ever had any kind of inkling of violence in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Does that fit the type of person you think that would commit an act like this?
I mean, this doesn't sound like, I mean, I'll let you talk, Kathy, but it doesn't sound like a first offense mm-hmm. kind of thing. But what do you
No,
think?
And that's the problem, right? I mean, you said no criminal history. That doesn't mean that he was...
It means he didn't get caught.
Right, yeah. He hasn't assaulted other people or tried to abduct other children, and it just never got caught, never raised to police involvement or any kind of witnesses that had come forward later. And how much of an investigation did they actually do to find out what kind of a past this guy had?
Yeah, well, I mean, it seemed like, because the case was, contrary to what was reported in the media, the case was exceptionally weak against mm-hmm. Richard Allen.
So
it seems like they went to all lengths to find anything they could, you know, trying to find somebody to say he was violent, somebody to say that he had, and all I can tell you, I don't know how hard they looked, but I can tell you they weren't able to produce anybody to say that, as opposed to, you know, like Ron Logan, you know, I think maybe even two of his exes. I know for sure one, like, him was like, oh yeah, this happened. He was in jail for this. And there was one of them said that they were uncomfortable with the way he was talking to or acting around some 14-year-old girl that was there checking out the horses or... Mm.
It's It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day Sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Moro Casino. America's Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Have you guys looked at all like when the video was released, the 43-second video, to like listen to what the girls were saying and how that went? Because that was we did an episode on that too, where we kind of like really broke down what they were saying, and my take on it was very different from what the state's kind of. There's like the innocent camp thinks this is happening, the guilty camp thinks this is happening. Personally, the big takeaway for me was the interaction. When they talked to him, indicated to me that they had already talked to him.
Mm.
You know, so you know what you hear. You know, the girls get across the bridge. You know, they I think Abby was the second one to kind of come across. Libby's filming, and you know they say something to him like, "Oh, is he still behind me?" or something like that. But it's hard to hear. And then he comes across and he says, "Guys," and they go, "Yeah." Or hey, you know, like there's something about the response that indicates to me
again.
Yeah. And they're prior to that, they're saying, "Oh, there's no path over here. We'll have to go this way." And he goes down the hill and the camera's pointed at her feet. And you hear him say, "Guys, down the hill." And immediately they just start walking. And it's just my gut instinct, it would be totally wrong. But the way my thoughts were, this guy told them he wants to show them something. And they're probably, and it seemed like they're uncomfortable with the situation, but they feel like he's a person of authority and they're going to follow him.
But she's recording this deliberately, right?
It's hard to know though with kids though, because they're Snapchatting everything all the time.
Mm.
Right.
So, I don't know.
And they're not recording him, but she is uncomfortable enough, but then. And I always thought the reason we only got that little snippet is I thought, oh, she put the phone in her pocket, she recorded the whole thing, and we're hearing their murders is why they're not releasing it.
Mm.
And then come to find out, it was, you know, she just, when he said down the hill, she just shut the camera off. Like she just hit stop on the recording. That was the end of it.
Mm.
So it's just those few seconds, like the recording, Abby coming across and Bridge Guy's kind of walking behind him. She runs across and they're like, "Oh, there's no path over here." And then he's like, "Guys, yeah, down the hill." And then they immediately, without hesitation, start walking down the hill. But there's
chances
no...
Chances are there was a gun being pointed at him at the time, and that's a scary thing.
And that's what I would love for you guys to look at as experts, because to me, I don't think there was a gun pointed at them. I think he was leading them somewhere that they already knew they were going. I think the girls were... very, you know, two teenage girls as grown men, so say, "Oh, I got, you know, imagine I've got, you know, a puppy that I want to, you know, check out this puppy," and they don't want to, but they're just complying because they're teenage girls and they're complying with this big scary guy.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to.
But this needs to be a 6-part series on Real Crime Profile where you guys need to go through all of this, because it's a complicated and fascinating case. Yeah. And it's
definitely going down the rabbit hole on that case.
Yeah. Right?
I didn't mean to. It was one of those cases.
But it's just like Eton Pates. I mean, you know, I firmly believe that the guy that they have locked up, that now they're talking about going after for a third trial, I don't think he did it. I think the guy, and I can't remember his name right now. I'm sorry, because you have Richard Allen in my head right now, but. Here's a guy who my old detective partner had arrested shortly after Eton Pates went missing. And this guy was bringing two little blonde kids into a parking garage and taking out his penis when Joe arrested him. It turns out that guy was the boyfriend of Eitan Peitz's babysitter. Mm-hmm. And he had molested her son. And he gave her son a box of Matchbox toys, little cars, that Eitan used to own. And he said that he met Eitan that day and was going to molest him, but couldn't. So he put him on a train to upstate. And this guy that they arrested, who was a paranoid schizophrenic, who was a 19-year-old and working in a deli or a bodega right by where Eitan would have had to walk by, said, you know, he had moved to Jersey somewhere and he told people back in New York, I did something bad. I hurt that kid. He's paranoid, right? So at the time when it happened, he was a 19-year-old working in this bodega and all the police came and everybody's looking and this kid is missing. And they asked him questions. They asked everybody questions. And that probably got implanted in his brain because never before or never since, and the guy's in his 50s, right? He's never touched a boy since then. There was no motive for him to kill. He was 19 years old. 19-year-olds don't start off in their crime, career by killing a kid, abducting and killing a kid, and then never do anything again for their entire life.
Yeah.
But this other guy, we have multiple cases of him sexually abusing boys in that age group, and he had access to Eitan through his girlfriend, and he molested her kid and gave that kid the box of Matchbox toys that Eitan always carried with him. And he said he was going to molest him, but he couldn't, so he put him on a train, which makes absolutely no sense. So that guy is the guy that should be prosecuted, just like in this case, he passed away just recently. He was in jail for a very long time for molesting boys.
Yeah.
That's the history that he has. And there were two other boys that he tried to lure into a tunnel in Van Cortlandt Park. And he stole their backpacks and tried to get them to run into the thing. And they basically, you know, ran the other way, called the police, and he got arrested. But the fact is that this guy is a much better suspect than the guy that they prosecuted.
Right.
So it happens.
I'm curious if you guys will end up with it. And I just realized, God, we've already been going for an hour. We better wrap this.
Yeah,
wrap this
we should
thing
wrap
up.
This up.
And I know you got another road trip yet tonight, but, yeah, listen, I just gave you guys 6 weeks worth of content.
You guys,
I'm telling you, you'll be surprised. I would love for you guys to cover it and then I'll have you guys back on.
Sure.
And we'll talk about it again.
Great.
But Kathy, it's been amazing meeting you.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm grateful to be speaking to you and I'm looking forward to working with you more. It's fascinating stuff that we're talking about. So
yeah, me too. It's been great. And Jim, it's been amazing to have you like here at my house in my studio.
Yeah,
this has
absolutely
been fantastic. So I guess next time it's my turn. I got to go to California.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bob, thank you for raising these issues because, again, my default is basically to believe when the system works, it works. But I know there are times when the system doesn't work, when people make mistakes or out of eagerness or out of malintentions, we get the wrong result. I mean, it's why Truth and Justice exists, right?
Yeah.
And
Real Crime Profile. Because one thing I want to point out is what you guys listening here just witnessed is what makes a really good and honest investigator. You guys go back. If you listen to the beginning of this episode, I mentioned Richard Allen, and both of you guys are like, they got the right guy. Both of you were interested to hear more information.
Oh yeah,
you got more information, and it raised a lot of questions. You're like, yeah, I want to look into this. You know, not that I'm gonna, because I don't want to convince you to do, but the fact that that's where mistakes get made. That's how cases end up in our dojo at Truth and Justice is when they get the blinders on, they made up their mind. A bad investigator won't take new information and consider it. So, like, you know, that's just one of the things I love and appreciate about you guys. It's like, hey, if there's no information, let's look into it and let's see. You know.
Right. Yeah. And I, you know, I did say right away that, look, I didn't have the opportunity to read through the transcripts and watch the trial. I didn't. And I trusted the system. So maybe I was wrong to do that in this case. But the system works in most of the cases, but certainly this kind of thing does happen. So I'm open to doing it. I have, unfortunately, my plate is very full, so it might be a minute before we're able to get to it on Real Crime Profile. But I appreciate it. I appreciate you raising the issues, because that's a really serious thing, and I want the right person to be in jail, and I hope that that happens.
And with that, we'll go ahead and wrap things up for Truth and Justice, and I'll let you guys wrap it up for Real Crime Profile. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm sure we'll have a lively follow-up next week. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
What if you could get more from what you already do? When you're a Shell Fuel Rewards member, you can. When you join, you'll save 10 cents per gallon on your first fill, 20 cents per gallon on your second, 30 cents per gallon on your third, and more savings on every fill after that. Join the Shell Fuel Rewards program in the Shell app and enjoy life with more. Your nearest Shell station is closer than you think.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Lots of places can accidentally expose you to identity theft. Doctor's offices, online retailers, insurance companies, the list goes on. Thankfully, LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. LifeLock keeps an eye on your personal information, credit applications, finances, and more. And if they find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, they alert you right away. All through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Even better, alerts are automatically activated the moment you become a LifeLock member. No extra work on your part. Get the alerts that could make all the difference. Don't wait. Join LifeLock now. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.